Rob Walker writes the weekly column Consumed for the New York Times Magazine. He's also the author of a book called Buying In, The Secret Dialogue Between What We Buy and Who We Are. Walker talked to Steve Paulson about branding.
First of all, my view of branding is that sometimes people think like, well, is it the logo design or is it the ad? And it's those are elements, but really branding is the process of attaching some kind of idea to something. 100 years ago, that idea might have just been quality, but today you see the ideas attached to things are more and more aimed at, they're bigger for one thing. Like you, I'm sure you're familiar with the Dove campaign for real beauty, mm-hmm. for facial creams and stuff like that. And they're making a statement about the nature of beauty itself. That's a pretty big idea to try to communicate through a brand. But the second part of it is that it is a two-way process. It's never just a company sort of announces something and says, this is what our brand means. And so therefore that's the end of the story. Consumers participate in that, and they're either willing to participate in the idea that the company puts forth. In that case, people have clearly been willing to go buy magazines that have interviews with the women in the Dove ads in them and have water cooler conversations and text in their votes and things like that. But then there are other examples of things like Timberland boots or Pabst Blue Ribbon beer, where essentially new meanings for a brand were created by consumers, and the company had to come around and adjust to what the consumers had decided the brand meant.
These are some fascinating stories. For instance, Pabst Blue Ribbon beer, which frankly was a beer that kind of everyone had forgotten about.
Yeah.
And then somehow it was rediscovered without really the company itself knowing that.
Yeah, and it literally sort of year over year for a quarter of a century, their sales were declining, which is a pretty tough thing to reverse in general. And they finally had dropped below, I think, 1 million barrels a year, which is kind of a threshold of, wow, they've really fallen off the map for something that used to be a mass brand. And kind of almost for fluky reasons, it was picked up in Portland as kind of the beer of choice of kind of young bike messengers and college students and stuff like that for reasons having to do with a local brewer going out of business. And that was kind of the cheap beer. The company itself had no idea why this was happening. Why are people picking it up and what does it mean to them? And they had to sort of dispatch one of their employees out to Portland to look around and meet these people and figure out what it meant to them. And it turned out that one of the attractions for these young folks was the idea that it was kind of a dead or dying beer, which meant that there was no marketing around it. It kind of had an outsider anti-marketing vibe to it almost. I went out to Portland to talk to some of these people, and they told me, well, I like the fact that they're not in your face with advertising, and I hate all that advertising. So it kind of became, PBR kind of became the anti-brand brand.
It creates a dilemma then for the company. They suddenly realize, oh, it's kind of become hip, not for anything that we did, but for other reasons. How do we take advantage of this? We can't really create an advertising campaign because that'll kill it.
Well, they did something pretty clever, and they did think through all that, and their first instinct was, in fact, oh, good, we'll advertise on alternative rock radio or something, and then they kind of figured out that that would be a bad idea. And instead, what they did was they kind of sidled up to these groups, these, like, bike messengers who would play goofy bike polo games in the park and stuff like that, and they would say, well, why don't we give you $500? You know, we'll be the sponsor of it. You can buy some new equipment, or we'll just give you beer. If you'll kind of, you know, there wasn't even a quid pro quo, really. It was just sort of a building the word of mouth kind of strategy. And it worked really well because the bike messengers there would alert their bike messenger friends in San Francisco and New York and everywhere else to say, hey, these PBR guys, they'll help you out. And that ended up being a major spreader of kind of the anti-establishment, if you want to call it that, cachet that PBR picked up, and it's continued to this day.
And these bike messengers and sort of the other people they hang out with, they don't feel like they're getting used doing this?
Well, no. By and large, I mean, I think that they feel that they're participating in it. You know, I'm sure that the answers will vary depending on which individual you're talking to, and some people do walk away and so on. But, you know, the ones that I spoke to, their feeling was, look, we don't really care about what the agenda of PBR is. We have our agenda, which is that we get some beer and we get to have our games in the park, and we don't care about them. So they can do what they want.
Now, you've coined a word to describe this kind of thing, marketing, which is not exactly marketing, but it's sort of, I don't guess, the new version of marketing.
Yeah, it's the murkier version of marketing, and that's why I use that word. And that came about through reporting on stories like this one. I would say it became emblematic to me of The shift on the other side of the coin, when we talk about things like TiVo or the internet and other technologies that kind of give us more control over traditional forms of advertising or the ability to avoid traditional forms of advertising, once it became clear that, well, we can zap past 30-second ads, that the advertising industry wasn't going to sit still and say, oh, well, you know, we give up and we roll over and call our clients and say, forget it. Instead, they had to come up with new tactics, new ways of getting at people, and these murkier tactics where it's not even clear, well, is that an ad or is that something else? You see it in forms like these things like with PBR that happen completely outside of media, but also increasingly you see it in media itself with shows in which the sponsor is kind of integrated into the program.
Hmm. And then on the other hand, there are stories like Timberland boots, sort of this old line outdoor boot for hiking that somehow became hip in cities.
Yeah. And this is a case of consumers coming up with a different set of meanings for a brand than what the brand managers had in mind. The people who own Timberland had a very clear idea of what they were all about, and it was sort of a combination of outdoor and sort of New England factory man, you know, very blue-collar kind of image. And it was picked up by a much different consumer, which was an urban kind of hip-hop consumer, African-American in the beginning. And then as hip-hop became a bigger idea across the culture, it was, of course, picked up in the suburbs as well and all kinds of people who, it just became sort of a standard uniform almost of hip-hop culture. And there was a period when the company really resisted this and did not want to see their product as, in effect, a fashion product. They were frightened by that. They didn't like the idea that it would be, in effect, fashion, because they saw themselves as being very function-oriented. And eventually, they essentially capitulated to what the consumer wanted and started manufacturing pink and blue and different colored Timberland boots because that's what the consumer wanted. And the meaning of the brand had fundamentally changed. And things like advertising in Vibe magazine, which they had resisted, they decided that they had to do because that's where the consumer was.
So why would these hip-hop people ever take to Timberland boots, you know, this outdoor recreational boot?
Well, to some degree, the answers to that involve just passing along legends, which I guess is what I'll do. I mean, the story goes that the Timberland boots actually also hold up very well in the urban environment and the sort of broken glass and that kind of thing, but also particularly among, and please let me just be clear that this is probably folklore, but drug dealers in the beginning who were out on the street all night also needed warm, waterproof boots, and these were the highest end, best. They were actually using them for functional reasons. But as we've seen in other scenarios, the line gets a little blurry about who sets trends and things like that. And it was clearly before long adapted by people. And you see them in suburbs to this day. They get sort of young hip-hop kids who have absolutely, they could probably be barefoot. The streets are so clean, but the Timberland boots are the ones to wear.
You end your book with a quote from Chuck D of the rap group Public Enemy, who's talking about the make something from nothing culture that he thought was a big part of the early days of hip-hop. And Chuck D said, "It was you that was important and everything else would define you after you defined yourself. It wasn't like a brand defined you, you defined the brand." Do you think we've reached that point in our society?
Well, I use that quote because he's saying something in a really memorable way that is said in other ways by people who have studied this stuff with more of an academic bent. And it's really easy to get lost in this process. And a lot of advertising is meant to kind of get you into a position where it's aspiration that you're buying. You're buying things that reflect the person that you want to be. And this is true even with sort of virtuous products like the eco-friendly dishwashing detergent or something like that. Hey, you want to be participating in solving the Earth's problems. Why don't you buy this brand of detergent? Meanwhile, you're not really changing your behavior in any way. So it's not actually reflecting who you are. It's kind of reflecting something that you want to be, or you're hoping that it will somehow turn you into that person. And I think, you know, we're in this shaky economic moment right now where a lot of people are rethinking their consumer habits. And I think that his words and the general point is really well taken, and now, in a funny way, is a great opportunity to really stop and say, what is important to me and how should my consumer decisions reflect that, as opposed to the other way around?
Rob Walker is the author of Buying In, the secret dialogue between what we buy and who we are. He also writes the Consumed column for the New York Times Magazine. Walker spoke with Steve Paulson.